You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding.
What happens if I drink coffee like this?
We call that a swill switch.
You are listening to Radio Berkman. My name is Daniel Dennis Jones, and this week we have a very special treat. It's the fifth episode in our series, Lessig and Zittrain Take On. This week's episode is a long one, so I'll let them jump right into it. If you couldn't figure out from the opening, this week hosts Larry Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain are taking on...
Kill Switches, a subject that had not really been on anybody's mind. The idea that you couldn't just have internet disruptions, but wholesale deprivation of internet access across an entire region or country. This, of course, more recently, it being 2011, has entered the public consciousness around the world, as we have seen in Libya, in Egypt, maybe elsewhere, attempts by governments to pull the plug on communications infrastructure, including the internet. And in America, debate over a bill sponsored by Senators Lieberman and Collins, for which the current title is Protecting Internet Freedom as a National Asset Act or something like it, 2011. The Cybersecurity and Internet Freedom Act. Well, anyway, there's an act. It has a title. It doesn't include the word job killing in it, but it will. And the point of that, some say, involves an internet kill switch juxtaposed with the actions we just saw overseas. We're here to try to sort all of it out today. And Larry, is there anything you want to say before we get started?
I want to get started.
Okay. Larry is in his typical good mood. And with it, we first turn to Brett Solomon from Access Now, joining us by Skype. Brett, would you just do a quick introduction for yourself?
Yep, sure. Hi, Brett Solomon is my name. I'm the executive director of Access. We're a global movement for digital freedom. We emerged out of the Iranian election of 2009. And our focus is essentially to keep the internet open, given all of the threats that currently face it, whether they be political or economic or military or what have you. And with a particular focus on the rights of people, quote unquote, on the other side of the firewall to access the internet and the digital sphere, so mobile networks inclusive.
So if you can just give us your best sense of what's been happening overseas to America in Libya, in Egypt, with the pulling of the plug, metaphorically at least, on internet access. Our best guess, I don't know how much you've been following, of how it came about, how it was affected, and to what extent making that happen was specific to the infrastructures of those countries, or if it's the kind of thing that could basically happen anywhere?
I think it's important to think about the internet kill switch as a both a legal and technical capacity, i.e. in the Egyptian situation, those powers were actually granted to Mubarak under the emergency, the 29-year-old emergency law. And I think whichever country we see developments in relation to this, there's always going to be some kind of legislative process, even in the cases of a dictatorship. In the US, as you say, this act, which is, Orwellianly named cybersecurity and internet freedom, which I think is kind of interesting, you see that there's a legal basis in a liberal democracy, but as I say, also, in dictatorships as well. And then on the technical side, it's very different. I mean, I'm not going to claim to be a technologist, but certainly it's clear that different countries have different control over their capacity to shut down. I think it's unlikely that in any country there is a switch as such, but there are certainly mechanisms that they have before them in varying capacities at a technical level. So, for instance, in the Egyptian case, there's really two processes that happened. One is that they removed all of the border gateway protocol routes, which are essentially the paths that that servers use to exchange information and advertise their address. So they removed the border gateway protocols from the international address book, in a sense. And at the same time, they also took action at the domain name system level, at the DNS level, so that any attempt to resolve a domain that ended in EG would fail. And so essentially what happened was that, you know, there's four major ISPs, and through them, they managed to basically, with some heavy phone calls, as it appears to be, to remove the border gateway protocols, and as a result, take the Egyptian internet off the map. It lasted for 5 days. But I think it's interesting in terms of other countries that this is actually, like, if we look at what happened in Iran, if we look at what happened in Tunisia, it appears as though this is a ratcheting up from, like, IP blocking of particular sites, or censorship of particular words, to actually making the decision that they're going to take the whole internet off the map. And we're seeing also, you know, in Bahrain, for instance, a similar kind of process, but not to the same extent.
And given that we now have at least a few weeks distance from these actions, one hypothesis going in, especially since it really hadn't happened with very limited exceptions, Nepal at one point, but just basically not happening, affecting lots and lots of people. One hypothesis would have been that any instance in which the internet is diffused enough to be a genuine threat to a government of its people organizing in revolt or something is also a situation in which the internet is diffused enough that the government really can't afford to take it down because it's so intertwined with commerce, with daily activities. And in the case of Egypt, it went back up again before Mubarak fell. So does it actually indicate, perhaps, I mean, I know it's all inference, that it might be a bad bargain to try to be so crude about taking down the entire net?
You know, it radicalized the population. It radicalized people because it is so intertwined, as you say, in everyday life, that it turned the middle class and people who use, I mean, remember, it was also about mobile phones as well. It turned them into opponents of the state because the state was seen to be debilitating their everyday life. In terms of economic activity, I think the most recent report is $110 million it cost the government, which was seen to be a small price when its very existence was under threat. And then I think it also is a question of timing as well. So, for instance, had they cut the internet at an earlier date, it may have been more effective for them. Not that I'm advising dictatorships on how to suppress their people, but certainly when it happened at that moment, it brought more people onto the streets. And the conversations that I've had with Egyptians is that it actually backfired.
And finally, do you have a sense of the state of play for alternatives that maybe were pretty far back on the shelf, more thought experiments than anything else, but maybe now a little bit more practical and vital for how to achieve internet access in an instance in which the usual routes have been shut down, or how to make it so that the day-to-day infrastructure is more robust, that it takes more phone calls, more effort to turn it off?
Well, I think one thing that's certainly the case is that even when it gets shut down, the ingenuity of both the system, which is so diversified, and the people prevent it really from taking place wholesale, in the sense that, you know, we saw ham radio, we saw seepage from across the border, we saw international dial-up, speak to tweet, etc. So the people responded because, you know, in a way it's kind of like the very basic communication channels had gone, and therefore people had to rely on their own other alternatives and their own ingenuity to cut through. And as I say, also, I think that the system itself, like, for instance, the DNS, you know, the secondary servers that actually collect information, and send it back, even if the original DNS system is not in place, provides a mechanism which makes it very difficult for, you know, for Mubarak and others to actually shut down the internet. It's different in every country, you know, like, for instance, Nepal has a much greater stranglehold on it because it has one point of access, for instance.
It must be the case that as you think about this as a problem around the world, which your organization tries to do, there are certain infrastructure designs which make countries more vulnerable than others. So Africa famously faces the problem that they have continue to have monopoly telecommunications infrastructure, largely because it turns out to be the easiest way to collect taxes. So these serve as effective taxing mechanisms, but it produces a regime where it's much easier to imagine affecting that kind of control in a country with that infrastructure than in a country which has multiple infrastructures or multiple ways in which you might layer an internet on top of an infrastructure. Is that how you're looking at it?
I think that's right. And the other point that's very relevant here is the role of corporations in this, because it's not just about government control or government oversight or management of the system. It's also about the relationship with corporations. So if you particularly think in the Egyptian example of Vodafone, which was both incidentally a mobile operator and the owner of an ISP as well, one of the four large ones, or a majority owner, you can see that it actually requires complicity of corporations. And we, Access, had launched a campaign against Vodafone on this. And they basically said, look, we had no choice, that the legal, that the contractual licensure agreement meant that we had to comply. We need to make sure that corporations have audited their agreements with governments, and that users, that we ensure that, you know, with Vodafone et al., that we're not prepared to support companies that are going to go into an arrangement with a government that is essentially prepared to put its own well-being, and admittedly that of its staff as well, ahead of the rights, the human rights of the population.
But the United States government didn't need to have a contract with Amazon or with eBay to have people like Senator Lieberman effectively bully them off of their cooperation with WikiLeaks in the context of the kill switch. So it's not enough to defend contract rights. You also have to have a political culture that would react negatively to that kind of pressure. And it's a little striking that even here, we didn't have a sufficiently strong political culture that would have taken that idea off the table.
I think it's a combination of both, you know, sort of corporate economics, branding, positioning, etc. And to that end, you know, we're establishing an ISP freedom of speech index, so we can see what kind of policies ISPs have in place to prevent the WikiLeaks takedown. And it's also the situation whereby a company just doesn't respond to a phone call by one senator unauthorized to take them off the books. So, yes, I concur with you, Larry.
There's also, in the context of infrastructure, there's a great project that's just been launched by Eben Moglen, who was one of the founders of the Free Software Foundation, and now continues to run Software Freedom Law Center, called the Freedom Box project, which is going to produce...
That sounds Orwellian.
Yeah.
We're locking you inside the Freedom Box.
So these will be like power supply size units that you will install at your point of access that will create a layer of privacy for your interaction with your friends. And but if the network goes down, serves as a points for a mesh network that it would build on top of it. So you can imagine finding a way to guarantee that they couldn't kill the network in a context like
and
that.
And I guess it's also meant to support mesh applications, so that so long as you've got internet access, even if Facebook goes down, you can run Diaspora and you've got a server within your apartment building that people can feel like is Facebook, and without the apartment building having to be connected to the rest of the world.
That's the objective.
Yeah, you've got that as well.
You are listening to Radio Berkman, and this week's very special edition, Lessig and Zittrin take on the kill switch. The word kill switch has been very present in the headlines most recently, with internet shutdowns in the Middle East and North Africa, which have been implemented mostly to make it more difficult for protesters to share information and threaten the power of authoritarian regimes. But the idea of an internet kill switch has been promoted here in the United States under the guise of a very different objective, preventing a cyber attack. Andrew McLaughlin, a former Berkman Fellow and until recently the Deputy Chief Technology Officer for the United States, came on to discuss the international situation with regards to the security of internet infrastructure and the situation in the U.S.
Andrew, what are you up to now? And if you want to help us, feel free to weigh in on the international situation we've been talking about, and then maybe we can cant it towards the Lieberman-Collins bill that has gotten so much attention in the U.S.
One note, just a technical note on something that Brett said, but I think it's important to surface. And that is that the withdrawal of the BGP routes from routing tables in Egypt was a symptom, not a cause. In other words, the government didn't direct that routes disappear. Rather, the evidence suggests that what they did was literally physically unplug their interconnected ISPs at two exchange points in Cairo, the Cairo Exchange and the Ramses Exchange. And the reason that that's important is that it points to a particular feature of Egypt's internet, and it's one which, as Larry noted earlier, is mirrored in a lot of developing countries, which is massive concentration in physical handoff of packets from the country to the outside world. And in Egypt's case, the way that they accomplished this was they said all international interconnectivity has to be handled by Telecom Egypt, which is their legacy monopolist. That meant that packets from the mobile companies, as well as packets from their ISPs, and they actually have a pretty competitive ISP market, a pretty diverse and competitive ISP market, downstream at the retail level in Egypt. But for packets to go internationally, they all had to get handed to Telecom Egypt, which managed these exchanges.
And do you think that was in anticipation of possibly having to pull the plug someday?
I think that it was the usual nexus of kind of fear, corruption, cluelessness, and habit that keeps these monopoly telecom companies in the driver's seat. And so I don't think it was I think the government felt more comfortable knowing that TE was in charge of international links. But I don't think that there was some kind of grand scheme that they knew that at some point they might need to kill off the internet. I think rather they just wanted to make sure that TE, with its sort of two advantages of predictable revenue flows into the government plus the kind of revolving door corruption that made regulators want to keep a strong incumbent that was Egyptian-owned in place because it would give them a place to get jobs after their tenure, that for those reasons they kept those links concentrated.
I don't want to deny that there's a problem of corruption somewhere, and no doubt there's lots of corruption there. But it's also, I think, you know, we have to confront a really hard fact about different cultures and their ability to support government services. So do you disagree, Andrew, that in this part of the world, these monopoly telecoms are actually pretty efficient ways to collect revenues? And if they don't have any other way to collect revenue, that might be driving them to maintain these monopoly telecoms when obviously clear-thinking telecom people would tell them that's a mistake?
Yeah, I think you absolutely have to be sympathetic to developing country governments that typically, you know, get nothing but strings-attached money, you know, from the international world, little trickles of tax revenues from their own commercial activities and their custom systems. And in that universe, the telecom taxes are you know, often their best source of discretionary revenue that they can use to support their budgets and services to their people. So absolutely, that's been a totally legitimate driver. On the other hand, you know, this pattern started with international calling revenues, and throughout the 1990s and in a much accelerated way over the last decade, those revenues have just been drying up. The international settlement system has been collapsing, some of that is because of tools like Skype, which we're doing this podcast on, and voice over IP, which, you know, allows people to, you know, do voice communications essentially for free. So these revenues have been plummeting, and what's been really interesting is to see, you know, governments take one of two tacks. Either they liberalize their markets in order to get a bunch more players and have a somewhat more complicated but still robust tax system, or they cling to the monopoly because it has, you know, been a good you know, revenue generator in the past, and they can't really envision how they're going to get by without it. I should say, as a footnote, a really, really interesting thing which has happened in Kenya, which points to sort of the perils of government dependence on communications revenue, is in Kenya, a foreign company, an Indian company, bought the largest competitive cell phone provider in Kenya and promptly set out to slash prices. and, you know, dramatically cut per minute prices. Now, for ordinary Kenyans, this is a massive boon because it means that their somewhat stultified marketplace, in terms of price anyway, is going to suddenly be delivering a lot more value for money. But the government panicked because they're, I think, at this point up to about 25 or 30% of their budget comes from the internet and mobile phone sectors. And so suddenly they're looking at dropping prices, meaning dropping tax revenues. And they got very worried and actually pushed the company to make its price cuts temporary so that they could go back to a predictable system. So the trade-off, you know, or sort of the sympathy that one has for these governments has to be countered against the fact that, you know, the ones who are sort of suffering as a result are the citizens for whom communications is a lot more expensive than it should be in a competitive marketplace.
So you saw kind of from the point of view of the U.S. government a bunch of these issues that are all kind of interconnected. But getting back to the kill switch issue, do you see a role for governments that believe in a free internet, at least generally, if not specifically, to be doing something additional, or is it keep on keeping on? Are there certain technologies that you think should be subsidized or encouraged or adopted that would actually help in times of stress or trouble?
I'm not sympathetic to the idea that in 2011, with the communications infrastructure we have, that the government needs any particular ability to seize control of communications assets. In 1934, Congress passed a Communications Act that is still the basic framework for communications regulation in this country. And it includes something called Section 706. And Section 706 gives the president the ability in times of public peril or disaster or other national emergencies to essentially seize control over any communications infrastructure that he or she chooses. It's important to sort of reconstruct the state of mind that would have caused Congress to give the president this authority in 1934. Back then, the scenario that they had in mind was you had these intercity long-haul lines connecting, let's say, Washington and New York. And the thinking was that in time of war or maybe in the time of a big earthquake or something like that, you could have major disruption of these lines and so much congestion going over them that either the U.S. government's relief apparatus or the military or the governmental command and control might need to ensure that it and only it could use the limited capacity that remained. And so they gave the president that authority.
And I'm just looking, as long as we're looking at it, it's Section 706, which of course is at 47 U.S.C. 606, subsection D. Upon proclamation by the president that there exists a state or threat of war involving the United States, the president, if he deems it necessary in the interest of national security and defense, may, during a period ending not later than 6 months after the termination of such state or threat of war, may, among other things, suspend or amend rules and regulations applicable to any wire communication facilities and cause the closing of any facility or station for wire communication and the removal therefrom of its apparatus and equipment.
That's right. And what's complicated about the statute and reflecting the fact that it was that bits of Section 706 were actually written at different times by different Congresses, some of the sections refer to war or state of public peril or disaster. Others refer only to time of war. There are powers to close facilities. There are powers to replace any FCC regulation with any regulation that he chooses, and so forth. And so,
and in fact, that provision I think dates from 1941, late December. I don't know what else was going on then, but
yeah, we can speculate. So, fast forwarding to 2011, the idea that is motivating Lieberman, Collins, and related proposals up on Capitol Hill, I think, and this is reading what they've said about it and also kind of reading into what I think they might be thinking is that on the internet today, there are kinds of attacks like a denial of service attacks or malware distribution that come from a particular network and that they could imagine a particular kind of attack coming from an identifiable source where the best thing for the country and the internet might be to basically kick that source network off of the internet until it can get its act together, until it can wipe out its end machine operating systems and replace them with something clean, or take the offending machines offline or whatever. But that's the picture that they have. And they believe that a national power on the part of the president, appropriately cabined, would be useful. There's a second related power that they think the president needs, which is the ability to identify key core critical infrastructure. The idea is that there's some bits of communications infrastructure that are so sensitive. So imagine the air traffic control system, or the communications which fuel our nuclear power plants, the communication system that the government depends on for its command and control. There are various and sundry systems that are so important that the president, through the Department of Homeland Security, ought to be able to specify baseline requirements for security that would ensure that they're being operated up to the right standards. And so those are the two sort of proposals. That's what's been characterized as a kill switch. And both of them strike me as bad ideas. And I think they're bad ideas because they don't reflect the reality of the communications network. I think they misunderstand the nature of regulation and what it means to regulate. And I think that the architecture of the internet and the communications network that we have can be made to achieve the ends that they're looking for without creating any of the risks of sort of downside risks of abuse that are inherent in a presidential power to declare something to be critical infrastructure and therefore subject to either particular security requirements or being booted off of
so,
the network.
So, Andrew, you don't disagree that these critical infrastructure entities need to have some standards here. You're just disagreeing that the government should be playing a role in getting them to those standards?
That's right. The regulatory process that it would take to go through to figure out what is, for example, a reasonable technical implementation for securing, let's say, the communication system for a nuclear power plant is likely to be so unwieldy and time-consuming and so prone to being outdated so rapidly that I don't really see the utility of it. It seems, if anything, more likely to be counterproductive to me.
So then what's the alternative? I mean, assuming that's got to be something, what's going to create the adequate incentive for them to adopt the right kind of security measures, given it's really a public good? It's a public good security problem.
Let me take the argument that you just put forward and let me say it in an even somewhat stronger form, which is something that I heard when I was in the White House from various parts of the defense and intelligence community, for example. They say, why do you internet people think that your infrastructure is so freaking special? We set requirements for security for ports, for power facilities. We set it for hospitals and healthcare information networks. We do all kind. We set requirements all over the place, transportation networks, the air traffic control system, and yet you somehow think that the internet is like a magical land where you uniquely should be immune from the government caring about whether you're adequately secure or not. We should just trust you and your people to get it right. And that was sort of this repeated theme, which is that the internet's not special, it's not different. And I guess I would say in response to that, it is not in fact special or different. This is really a tactical question of how to reach the optimal result, which is to say a secure and flexible network, a network which can speedily meet the changing needs of society, but is also adequately secure. And government regulation, just in practical terms, is likely to retard hitting that optimal result. And so the role for government then is to try to contribute and to push and to use its own network capabilities, in other words, its own role as a procurer and buyer and deployer of its own networks to contribute to that sort of optimal result. And I'll give you one example. One of the things which is quite striking is that all of the networks that get cited, I shouldn't say all, most of the networks that get cited as being core critical infrastructure are networks that to any security expert really ought to be air-gapped. In other words, built as a separate, distinct set of infrastructures and not just running over the public internet.
The nuclear power plant doesn't need a web-based login.
Correct. And now there, it's a little bit of a more complicated answer than that, because in fact there are certain kinds of systems at a power plant, for example, the HR system or the email system or something like that, you may actually want to give people remote access to. Just like any other employer, they may want to be able to let people access systems from home, but there is a set of parallel systems that ought to exist all by themselves. Same thing for the air traffic control system. In fact, it is air-gapped, and so cybersecurity, at least in the sense of threats from the public internet, is just not really much of a concern there.
But then when you're worried about regulation, regulation could be ex post or ex ante, right? So so you could require, the government could sort of set a list of technologies everybody needs to use, or entities could be responsible if it turns out that they did a bad job and they face significant liability for the harm that that's caused. And what's interesting in the context of software in general is that we've avoided both kinds of liability. So, you know, you put a car out there that is unsafe and people get hurt by it, then you're going to face significant tort damages. But you put software out there, there's nothing like responsibility for the harm that it's causing. Would you have the same concerns about the ex post liability that you seem to have about ex ante?
I wouldn't say I'm categorically opposed. I mean, I think the software question is interesting because there's been, I would say, largely a consensus around the idea that it would be highly detrimental to the production of new software if there were some kind of strict liability for faults. It's very hard to decide what is a fault, and we've generally allowed software writers to just, whether they're open source or proprietary or some combination, to sort of disclaim liability for things that they don't know about and can't predict, and for claims that they're not making. And I guess I'm still persuaded that that seems right. In other words, that imposing strict liability in that case would be a problem. So if you think about a network operator, I actually think the existing regulatory process, which is to say that regulations for security are handled by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the FAA in the case of the air traffic control networks, or the government through the requirements that it places on what are called the networks contractors, which is to say the five largest ISPs in the country that provide services to the federal government. The federal government can significantly influence the security practices of those network providers. And I think it's much more fruitful for the government to pursue activities in that area than to try to say, in general, we're going to make you liable for anything you get wrong. Mostly because it's very, very hard in a world of digitally interconnected computers where, for example, operating systems are built specifically to run executable code written by other people, to say that we're somehow going to require you to anticipate all of the threats which might come your way, and even using a reasonable care standard, take reasonable care. It's very hard to get sufficient business certainty for an innovation economy with that kind of an ambiguous rule set.
So I'll just flag, I'm puzzled by that answer. You know, first, you moved from strict liability to negligence, which is good, because obviously you wouldn't have to have strict liability. You could have negligence as a standard.
Just for those listeners who haven't endured the first-year legal curriculum.
Which John teaches.
And Larry, too. Strict liability generally means it breaks, you bought it. You give somebody a gizmo and it hurts them. Basically, you're going to have to pay for it. Negligence is a little more generous to you, the defendant. It says, well, only if you screwed up somehow in an identifiable way, fell below a standard, do you actually owe money.
Yeah, so, you know, you put out wireless routers and you put the default password, and so 90% of the people who deploy this deploy it in a way that's completely unsecure. It's a pretty stupid thing to put out the default password in a way that was, you know, password. One might say that just like every other part of the economy needs to think about how its behavior hurts others or puts others at risk, it would require a lot more to show why this part of the economy was so uniquely different, or so significantly different. Even if you agree, I agree with you, obviously it benefits software providers enormously not to have to worry about the harm caused by their product.
You are listening to Radio Berkman, and this week's very special edition, Lessig and Zittrin Take On. In this episode, Jonathan Zittrin, Larry Lessig, and guests Andrew McLaughlin and Brett Solomon take on the internet kill switch, along with some questions from the audience.
We have a room full of people here. So let's open it up to comments, questions, reactions on anything that we've talked about so far.
Sure. So I'm Dan Robinson. I'm a 1L at the law school. And my question is, what do you think of the new bills, specifically the part that says the president can't deactivate the entire internet? And Lieberman has actually come out and said this would be impossible even if he wanted to, and he should never want to. So I do think there are protections in the bill as it currently exists that are important for keeping for the cybersecurity of these critical platforms.
Well, I guess I think that's a little bit of a straw man. The question is, if the president has the power to declare any network or endpoint on the network to be a critical system and then subject it to either termination or whatever security requirements he might or she might promulgate, and then you can go and seek judicial review, which, by the way, is not even specified in this bill, but I think is assumed. The question is, does that give the president too much unreviewable authority to do harm? And I think my answer to that is that it is yes.
And I've just got to say, in looking at it, there is the point, as you brought up, Andrew, there's Section 706 of this 1934 Communications Act, which is already the kill switch, which this is on the Myth versus Reality page on the Senate site, that the Department of Homeland Security has already indicated that they are ready to pull 706 if they need to shut down the internet. Now, I guess you can say, well, maybe it's time to repeal or modify Section 706. But in the meantime, it does sound like they've already got the authority to do the crudest thing they might do. And in the meantime, this bill does identify this thing called critical information infrastructures, which in turn indexes to the Patriot Act. And that is defined pretty narrowly. They are, quote, only specific systems or assets whose disruption would cause a national or regional catastrophe. And to qualify as a national or regional catastrophe, there's actually a qualification test. You have to, like, meet these requirements. The disruption of the system or asset would have to cause mass casualties with an extraordinary number of fatalities, severe economic consequences, mass evacuations of prolonged duration, reminiscent of the South Park episode where everybody left South Park in search of internet connections, or severe – I'm sure that's what inspired it, actually – or severe degradation of national security capabilities, including intelligence and defense functions. So in that sense, one can make the case it might be ill-advised, it might be something to be tinkered with, but I suppose one could make the case this is a bill offered in good faith, not as a backdoor to offer a kill switch for the internet, but genuinely affecting worry that there are certain systems that you really need to be able on a Monday morning to declare what the bill calls a, quote, cyber emergency and deploy a cyber ambulance. But that is my own interpretation. Cyber ambulances, to be clear, not in the bill.
Yeah, I think the mission creep point is an important one. Jay-Z and I were commenting about, is it the light rail system in Britain, in London? We were talking about
yeah.
So if they have these wonderful signs that threaten that if you spit on a conductor, they will use the National DNA database to track you down. And of course, the National DNA database in Britain was established for the purpose of tracking down rapists and murderers. But the mission creep was obvious, and now we're down to catching spitters.
Pretty cool, though. Like, that's so cool. Like, what excuse do you have for spitting on a transit officer? Like, really, this is your nightmare scenario? They're going at first, they came for the spitters, and I said nothing because I was afraid I would get spittle on someone. You know, like, come on.
But I think part of this is just we don't have any way of feeling confident that whatever regulation or whatever technology it gets mandated does exactly what the thing is supposed to do. And so because we can't feel confident about this at all, the response is, you know, understandably the kind of response that Andrew was making. Let's just not go down this road. Let's not take one step down the road because it's mission creep plus they're going to fold all sorts of functionality into whatever they deploy that does stuff that they say it's not doing, but who can tell because it's, you know, encrypted or hidden.
Well, I say that there's one other argument here, which I think is critical, which is that going down this road of terminating networks or setting regulatory requirements through the Administrative Procedures Act, it is a huge distraction from where the government really can be usefully focusing its energies. And You know, I know people hate it when this gets injected into the debate, in especially in Washington, because it seems so small and kind of inadequate to the vastness of the challenge that securing the internet, you know, dramatically should be understood to be posing. And that is that there are all of these things that are mundane security best practices that even the U.S. government systems, you know, 5 years after people have been pulling, you know, ringing alarm bells, are not doing. And it's things like there's an IETF document called BCP-30, and Bradner will correct me if I get the number wrong, BCP-38, which defines things like IP address ranges, which simply should not be publicly routable. There are best practices like your edge routers on your networks should not have publicly routable IP addresses. They should be using link local addressing, which is private and known only to the local machines. But these are all things. And Larry mentioned earlier, factory default usernames and passwords. I can't tell you what number, but a shocking percentage of U.S. government systems edge routers were found to, you know, a double digits percent number were found to have factory default user IDs and passwords.
But wait, so is this an argument? Is this an argument against the bill, or isn't it just like?
Yeah, this is an argument for going and doing the things which require no legislation and in fact generate security. And by the way,
no, but it sounds like you're telling me people aren't putting on their seatbelts, even though BCP-38 tells them to buckle up. And it's like, why not have a seatbelt law?
Right, but it's not at all clear to me that saying that cars in which the seatbelt buckle is not buckled should be, you know, kicked off of the highway.
Well, but that's not the analogy, right? It's that
that's not
bill...
actually. I was trying to think if I could make that analogy work, but it's
I
not.
I don't think so. I think no.
It's not actually going to fly.
Yeah, no, certainly not a flying.
No, but
car.
Anyway, yeah, my point is just simply that getting, you know, focusing a big part of the Department of Homeland Security apparatus around the project of APA rulemaking for security is a distraction of human talent from the things which would actually make the internet.
But how do you get people to buckle up unless one way or another you tell them buckle up or you're in trouble?
Well, there's a bunch of different ways. For example, for the major commercial backbone networks, the U.S. government can terminate its contracts with them if they are deemed to be inadequately secure. Right? You don't have to do an APA rulemaking for that. You can simply set your own requirements as an operator of network infrastructure and say that our upstreams have to meet these requirements.
Of course you could, but the point
that's superior to an APA rulemaking is just because all of the...
Can we put the kill switch for...
Larry.
Sorry, Andrew.
I'm now killed. You can tell.
But even to do that, you have to have standard process. You have to have a process to figure out what the standards are that you're going to be requiring. So somebody's going to be distracted even to the level of figuring out what level you have to have to qualify.
And of course, the purpose of an APA proceeding, whether it's good at this is another question, is to give every last person and his or her pet salamander an attempt to weigh in before anything happens.
Yeah, the differences here are in flexibility and timing. So of course, you know, government procurement is far from superior, but at least in terms of speed and flexibility, it is speedier than an APA rulemaking. And by the way, once the rulemaking is done, you know, to modify or change the rules is a painful process. To say that from the government perspective that our network experts are going to be careful and judicious and use their best technical judgment to decide what our interconnected upstreams ought to be doing is very different from saying, here are the rules that apply to all networks in the country that fall within this rulemaking.
How old were your computers that you worked with at the White House?
It was a gateway.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I also think just in terms of the security question, because if this is what, you know, the Act is trying to do, is trying to, I guess, to protect the national security and the, you know, the safety and well-being of society, I would actually argue that an open, multipolar, distributed network with communication channels which you know, are able to you know, alert health services and enable citizens to communicate with each other in a very kind of crowdsourced, you know, contemporary sense, creates, I would think, a safer environment than one in which people are unable. I mean, if we do talk about the whole, you know, internet shutdown, then one in which there's a centralized point where the government has total control and there isn't that kind of communication enables.
It creates such a delicious dilemma or paradox, because it says that on the one hand, is a network centralized enough that it can march to a single drummer, and as long as the drummer is competent at securing it, it gets secured. And on the other hand, is a network so distributed and robust and redundant that it doesn't matter if a large percentage of it is insecure and not following the protocols and everything, because there's enough overbuilding and enough heterogeneity in a good way, you know, a polyculture, that it is robust. And it's just funny to think that both are models of security, and maybe the worst is to have something halfway that's like not fully distributed, but at the same time not centralized enough to march to a drummer. Scott Bradner has been waiting to weigh in. He's the university technology security officer here at Harvard, columnist for Network World, secretary to the Board of Trustees of the Internet Society, and a trustee of the American Registry of Internet Numbers. Scott, take it away.
Couple of notes about the bill itself, and then a point, a continuation of a discussion. The bill does have a way for, if your infrastructure, the one you own, has been declared by the president a cyber infrastructure, you can appeal that in court. That's in the bill. The bill also, actually a good percentage of the bill, maybe half of it, applies to the federal government networks. It drives security requirements into the government networks very strongly. It does things like say that the managers of agencies can't get bonuses if their networks aren't secure.
And are you in favor of that?
Definitely. But what I wanted to actually go on to is something Andrew and the rest of you have been discussing. In the private sector, the aggressive cluelessness about security is just breathtaking. For example, in the smart grid that's being touted a lot, if you go right now to New York and Con Ed, you can get a internet control thermostat from Con Ed as part of an experiment. There is no place in any documentation for that thermostat that allows you to set a password for it or mention security in any way.
You'll know the Russians, or fill in your bad guy because we're friends with the Russians now, are coming when your house hits 90 degrees like the room we're in right now. Because it's under cyber attack.
Or when
come out with your hands up and your shirt off.
Or when it's 4 degrees out, they turn the heat off. So how do you deal with that in this environment where things are interconnected enough that it actually makes a difference if not necessarily Jonathan's thermostat gets turned off, but there's a lot of other places where there isn't an air gap where there should be, and things like that.
Your centrifuges are just hooked up to the net, or
actually
have a
USB
port.
They weren't, because right. The attack was via thumb drive. But
yeah, USB
that's,
port.
That's a different issue. But the basic question is, how do you deal with the aggressive cluelessness on the security space?
And aside from denying bonuses to clueless people, do you have?
That's only the government ones.
Right. So.
I don't have a solution, or I patented it a long time ago.
I see. Larry is sort of contemptuously to me saying, liability, you're the tort guy.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. I mean, this is your profession, right?
Just for the record, Larry teaches torts too.
Richard Clark, a number of years ago, the old cybersecurity guy, did want to have the government require that large organizations and internet service providers get insurance for cyber crimes and cyber events, just so the insurance companies would force them to be secure.
Yeah, although, I'm skeptical of it, because for insurance to work, you have to have a large enough N and a phenomenon that's the bad insured phenomenon that happens with enough regularity that an actuary can sit there and just say, this is the price, because we average it out over all the bad things. Whereas the kinds of attacks we're talking about, words like catastrophic damage to blah, 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 rather than the kind of Walmart shoplifting of one phished bank account at a time, these are the sorts of things that are really low risk, high impact, should they materialize, events for which insurance is really hard to get a grip on. It would be hard to price it. It would be hard to know what would happen should the terrible event happen. It's like, great, the country has been completely cyber attacked. The president ineffectually declared a cyber emergency because the law never passed, but he just did it gratuitously. And we're all, you know, in a smoking heap, but at least we'll be fully reimbursed for our losses is, you know, not where we want to be. Now, on the liability front that Larry has been pushing, I don't know that I'm buying it, because I worry that on the software design zone, any form of potential liability should you misdesign your software and make it open to purely economic harm, means a raft of lawsuits where the jury has to sort out the difference between the network administrator who failed to do X, the software that had a certain vulnerability that, thanks to the open firewall, was compromised, and then the interlocking but otherwise unrelated independently written pieces of software that came together to make that hack happen. And
but,
trying
but
to sort
evidence,
that out seems,
if the evidence were, and we took as our expert here Scott Bradner, if the evidence were really complicated security mistakes, you know, that geniuses could argue about and not really come to an agreement, then I'd agree with you. But you know, when we're talking about deploying routers with default passwords that, you know, anybody can guess, we're talking very, very low-level errors.
Do you believe in open Wi-Fi?
I do believe in open Wi-Fi.
That's a ridiculous security breach. I'm suing you.
You can't because you haven't allowed liability.
But
here.
If but I did, I would.
But you couldn't because I'm not deploying anything. The point is, if
no,
I'm in the
business, it's your home Wi-Fi network.
I'm speaking freely. We have a First Amendment. I'm allowed to say whatever the hell I want, and you can't sue me for negligence of what I say. God
this is
forbid.
The moment in the podcast where it literally goes from passive aggressive to aggressive aggressive. Please speak freely.
There should be some responsibility for deploying things into the environment that are plainly stupid and causing harm.
Plainly stupid standard.
But the point is, you teach a whole course which is focused on 1,000 contexts within which we make this judgment all the time. And yes. I don't understand why we can make this judgment in 1,000,000 different contexts. Toasters can't explode at your house. Your car can't. But in this one place, it's just too complicated. We just couldn't.
The part
possibly.
Of the complication, though, is that our infrastructure is not just distributed among lots of different companies. It's distributed among lots of different kinds of entities, the free software movement. Like, if it turns out that GNU Linux has some ridiculous flaw in it, I know that's impossible, but suppose it did. It's like, whom do we sue? Is it like Richard Stallman, like, answer for this? Pay in flutes? Like, I just, do you want to end up discouraging the generative environment which is not very amenable to the kind of regulation by lawsuit that you're wanting?
I'd be happy to say that we're talking about deploying commercial products. That's what we're talking about. So, you know, for example, routers, and deploying it in a way that doesn't
How about
impose
freedom boxes?
Externality.
How about freedom boxes?
Commercially deploying.
Freedom Somebody sells free. A freedom box. They're responsible for the contents. Nobody's going to sell freedom boxes anymore. You just killed Red Hat.
No. You can't say nobody's going to, because in all sorts of contexts, once you impose liability, it's not that people run away from providing the product. They just price it into the product.
Well, but it's hard for Red Hat, since they're not even making GNU Linux. They're just stamping it and selling it, to even know what they're doing at that point. I think they might well be just like, man, we don't know how to ensure this.
I'm not denying there's a hard problem in figuring out where to carve here, but I am denying that the answer is none, nothing. Everything's free. You get to do whatever the hell you want in this network. Given it's such a crucial part of the infrastructure of life right now, I just don't know why we are so worried about how the electricity standards are running inside our house, but when it's bits, we don't have any standards.
Well, part of it, too, is that bits don't generally cause physical harm. Now, I agree that line is starting to blur with the thermostat example and things like that.
Well, haven't you ever been hurt by a tweet?
Tweets don't kill people. Blogs do. Sorry, was there another question in the room? A little help here?
Hi, I'm Oliver Goodenough. I teach at the Vermont Law School, and I'm a fellow here as well at Berkman. As I listen to this, there's two or three things going on. One of them is you know, questions of how to make the government better, how to make the system better. I think that what is catching the popular imagination, particularly against the example of a place like Egypt, is the concern over the Big Brother aspects. Again, this is what is certainly gathering the attention. And What strikes me, and I'm not sure this is an association that anyone connected with the internet will like, is that we're actually talking about a kind of an internet Second Amendment, where what we're really concerned about is the ability of the government to pry.
You want a right to bear the internet.
Exactly. There we are. Exactly. So I throw that out as an observation, and would invite
the tree
comment.
Of liberty is watered with the bits of martyrs.
There we are. Exactly. You will pry my mobile device from my hands. You know, my dead cold hands is the last thing.
Larry,
I
you're a constitutional expert. You teach constitutional law.
I do, but not the Second Amendment. I agree that's a strong motivation, and there's a strong motivation based in very deep and well-justified skepticism about the government being able to do anything intelligent in this context. But I take this, there's a realism point about this. You know, Z is famous for Z theory, which is describing the conditions under which the government's going to have the political power to actually force onto our network the kind of regulations that they want to be able to facilitate control. And we're not prepared for that day because we haven't begun to develop ways of auditing or framing or understanding what the government's doing enough to be confident that what the government does is just what the government says it's going to do. Like, so in my view, we need something like, you know, the equivalent of independent judges, independent code judges or code courts that could look at what the government's forcing or requiring to be deployed and verify in a way that you're confident because you know that these people aren't hacks employed by the government. They've got some kind of independent standing.
In which case, you don't object to the basic thrust of the Collins-Lieberman bill. You want to tinker with it.
I want to tinker. Well, it's a don't paint me into that corner because you said you liked the basic thrust, too. But let's frame it like this. I think it's true. Something is going to have to happen to increase the standards on this network and make critical parts more secure. And the question is how we're going to do it. And if all the only way we do it is have some agency sort of say these are the things everybody has to deploy, then we're all going to be rightfully skeptical and given the experience with the technologies the government has deployed, very fearful that the technology is doing all sorts of things it's not supposed to be doing. So we can answer that. You know, historically, constitutional law will tell you, historically, we built independent institutions designed for the purpose of building trust into the system. And one of them would be an independent institution, independent in the sense that you appoint them, they can't be removed except for a really good cause. That would be able to verify the kind of thing we need to verify to feel confident about what gets deployed on the network.
I think the other thrust of Oliver's question, and Brett may have something he wants to weigh in on this, is when you start to think of internet access, not just in a Second Amendment style, if you can get it, you are allowed to kind of cling to it, but maybe you should have a kind of right to internet access. It's just part of breathing the air now, is a right to your bits. You start to think of it as that's the default. The government better have damn good reason to think about impinging upon it. And the configuration we want is basically everybody on a neutral net able to ship bits back and forth to any other point. And the mere fact that we can hypothesize or even point to evidence of misuse that we would all agree is misuse, the world is worse off thanks to it, is generally not reason for broad-based surveillance of the fishing expedition variety or restriction of the filtering variety any more than we ought to routinely have checkpoints on interstate highways looking for 18 of the things we could specify that really shouldn't be in the trunks of cars, whether it's contraband or kidnapped people or you name it. Brett, you probably want to say a quick word on this. I know we have to wrap up soon, but Scott wants to get in too. Brett, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, only just to say that I think that the world's people are ahead of the world's governments on this one. I mean, and if you look at the GlobeScan BBC poll on both people who had access to the internet and those who didn't and were asked, do they think that access to the internet is a fundamental human right? And across the spectrum, it was 4/5 of the world's people believe that. And then you look at the kind of international legal framework for this and people relying upon the UDHR, for instance. And
the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, just to unpack that.
Sorry. And, you know, how does that then relate to rights in the 21st century, which increasingly are expressed, enjoyed, and abused online? And so, you know, the Human Rights Council, for instance, is meeting next week. And one of the things it's discussing is just this, like how are states and how does international law actually provide the framework for people to rely upon when, you know, there are legislative proposals before parliaments around the world and Congress around the world that we have no means with which to judge whether it is rights respecting or not, because we don't have necessarily the framework in place or the norms established to determine.
One non-positive thing to end on, the Lieberman bill is 221 pages long. It was not written by their staff. It was written by somebody in government. It's clear.
You mean somebody in the executive branch?
Somebody in the executive branch, yes. One of the things that it specifically enables is monitoring of all of the interconnections between government networks and the internet, ostensibly for protection, for detecting attacks and the like, but not exclusively.
And now just playing devil's advocate a little bit there, the way the internet is designed, those at the endpoint sending and receiving data with one another are basically to assume that the envelopes containing their stuff are transparent envelopes, and it's up to them to decide to encrypt, no?
I don't believe that's the legal rubric under which we live right now. In fact, the government, in theory, under CALEA, has to get subpoenas.
You're thinking of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act.
Yes.
But I was asking, from a network design standpoint...
You have the security you bring.
Right. And in that case, the fact that there might be monitoring points at any hop along the way, encrypt end-to-end.
You should. It's actually exactly what you should do, but as it's been pointed out many times, it's like everybody in the world is using postcards. You start using envelopes, you get to be very suspicious.
Uh-huh. So that is sort of a, how did you put it, a depressing or un-something?
Non-positive.
A non-positive. We call that negative sometimes. That's impossible. Well... It is 2011. We're debating kill switches. We'll have to revisit this in 2012 and see what's happened in the interim. I think we all agree it's been an incredibly fascinating, fast-changing, busy time for those who think about the internet and its deployment. This has not been a usual three-month period in kind of the history of the internet, even though we like to say it moves at internet speed. So we'll be tempted to see just how much of our discussion feels dated or very 2011 when we revisit it later, especially once Larry's rubric of liability rules against stupidity, which has really been his lifelong dream to just legislate against stupidity, come into play. So on behalf of everybody at the Berkman Center, thank you for tuning into the podcast, and we will catch you a future time for podcast number 6, where the topic will be the internet. Till then.
This has been Radio Berkman and a very special episode in our series Lessig and Zittrain Take On with special guests Andrew McLaughlin and Brett Solomon. You can find out more about this topic and our guests on the show notes for this episode at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with Molly Soder and special help from Lisa Carlovati, Zelena Gray, and of course our two hosts, Lawrence Lessig and Jonathan Zittrain, and the folks at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. What I want to